Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to focus on a reality, a cultural, social reality, which is combining our passion for food with just about everything else in our life, including art and museums. The Carnegie Museum of Art in Pittsburgh is actually the Carnegie, then broken into four other museums: the Carnegie Science Center, the Warhol Museum, the Carnegie Museum of Art, and the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. But the Art Museum has started a series called Feast, and they had the first one of these, which apparently was a huge success, so I expect there could be others, where they invite chefs to come and compose a menu and present a dinner to guests in the museum correlated with the current exhibit. And the first one was a challenge. The first chef was somebody who's really important on the New Orleans food scene, Michael Gulotta, and one wonderful guy as well.
And if I can just put a word in edgeways here, if you wait till the end of the program, you'll see we're swinging around in a full loop.
Exactly.
Because we're back to New Orleans and food and cultural pursuits tied together there. So it's not a surprise. This program's sort of integrated all together.
Right.
And it turns out that thanks to Sonia Finn, who'll be appearing on the program just a little bit later, Mike Gulotta, a star chef from New Orleans, actually was the first to start the series here in Pittsburgh just a few weeks ago, and we caught up with him and asked him what it was all about.
I keep coming across the name of this chef, Michael Gulotta. Michael, welcome to On the Menu. I think that we ought to become best buds.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I hope we do.
Well, you have a really interesting background. Born and raised in New Orleans, where you work still.
Mm-hmm.
But you've had wonderful mentors, including I love John Besh. I mean, he's a wonderful mm-hmm. person. You've cooked in Germany for 3 years, Italy.
I was in Germany, Germany for a year and a half, and Italy for just about a year.
Okay, and your background is Sicilian, Irish, and French. Now, that's a mixture.
That's a typical New Orleans mud, I like to call it.
which part's which?
Yeah, well, mostly Sicilian, like a whole lot of French, but I look Irish. So that's kind of the way it went down.
Sort of lit up our dashboard with when you came to Pittsburgh to do that themed dinner at the art museum at the Carnegie Museum of Art called the series. It's a dinner series. It's going to be Feast. And mm-hmm. they're trying to match up the theme of the exhibits to the food for a special
right.
dinner. And lo and behold, they needed to find somebody who created food around Vietnamese and Creole flavors, and you were the guy.
Yeah, I was really lucky. The Propeller Group's Living the Delight That Doesn't Need Music, they just need to find someone who sort of spanned that gap, and I just happened to fit the bill.
I mean, now that I heard it, it makes perfect sense, but I would have never thought it. But, yeah. So, but I understand that you were outside in this below freezing temperatures cooking two hogs.
It was 8 degrees when we started roasting those hogs at about 5:30 in the morning.
That must have slowed down the cooking a bit, huh?
We were lucky enough. We got some really good rigs from a local company that had some really nice. I think they provided us with the hogs and the rigs to cook them in, and they were really well built and really done smartly, and to where the temperatures, once we got it hot, the temperatures really weren't a concern. Although they were concerning me so much, I just kept dumping. I think we went through a lot more fuel than I would have gone through if I was down in the south. But
yeah,
it ended up working out well. They only took about 8 hours, which is the same as it takes. I think if we were in warmer climates, probably would have taken us 5 hours. But an extra 3 hours really isn't much.
Right, yeah, and we've done a number of pigs as well as goats.
Right.
But, yeah, it's fun hanging around while the thing's roasting, but I'm not so sure at 8 degrees Fahrenheit that it would be that much fun.
Yeah, I made the mistake of, I was all bundled up, but I didn't have gloves.
Oh, no.
And so at one point I answered my phone while I was out there watching, tending to the pigs, and I didn't realize my hand was out of my pocket for like a good 20 minutes, and I went back inside, and my hand was throbbing for about 30 minutes. I was like, oh, I did not realize it was actually only 5 to 8 degrees out there.
Oh, wow. Now, your background, really, aside from regionally located in the South, in New Orleans, was really mainly in fine dining. You were a chef de cuisine at probably one of the best restaurants in New Orleans, Restaurant August, John Besh's restaurant, which we've eaten at many times and love. But when you decided to, and you didn't have to start out on your own restaurant, because a lot of people who work for John Besh go on like Alon Shaya, and then they partner with John and open their own thing. What made you want to spring free altogether and open your own restaurant?
Well, a couple of different reasons. I think it's because I had only ever done fine dining, and so it was kind of a hard move to see where I would go with that company. And so I decided, you know, I wanted to know what it would be like to do it from scratch and to really see and do it on my own and build it from the ground up. I guess I'm just sort of a masochist in that way, whereas I could have had something sort of built out for me, and I would have had all their media presence and all the things to go along with it to make sure the doors were always packed or the seats were always packed. But I kind of wanted to see what it was like to do it, start to finish, and to say that my partners and myself could build something from the ground up. Well, and I think that was the idea. Just you know, you only have one life to live, and if you're going to experience it in its fullest, you may as well go the hard route and say you've done everything you could have done.
Yeah, well, you've risked everything.
Yeah, hold on a minute. So the restaurant is called Mofo.
It sure is.
What is that? That must have a hidden meaning there somewhere.
Can say that. I think what it is we wanted to create a word. Well, there was multiple reasons to pick that name. Obviously, we're not traditional Vietnamese or Thai. We're not traditional New Orleans. We're kind of making up our own thing, so we kind of made up our own word. And also, when you know, we kind of threw that word around just as a joke when we first did. We kind of had just named the business plan Mofo, and then as we, you know, we got someone to kind of design a logo, and we kind of kept looking at it. We're like, well, it's actually a really solid name. It's really well balanced. It makes a good logo, and like if you're gonna have a brand that's gonna stick with people in people's heads, we figured that was a good one, and we just sort of made that decision to just go with it. And since then, I mean, people really love it, so we can't complain.
Now, where is it located in New Orleans?
So we're in Mid-City, which is right around where I grew up. And really, all my years cooking in restaurants when I was, less poor than I am now, I guess, I always lived in Mid-City because that was the place that had the cheapest rent, and so I was always surrounded by cooks and servers when I was in Mid-City. It was just sort of the place where we all lived. And still, my partners and I all live in that neighborhood, and so we thought if we're going to open a restaurant, we wanted to do a restaurant that was industry-centric. We wanted a restaurant that was for the cooks and the servers and the bartenders, so we figured what better place to do it than in Mid-City. And Mid-City was still kind of up and coming when we opened, or when we signed the lease 3 years ago. The only really chef-driven restaurants they had were Tubes Meadery, and back then they had Crescent Pine Sausage, which was Bart Bell, which has since closed, but there's, since then they've had a few other great restaurants open up, like Milkfish, which was Christina Quackenbush. Yeah, so Mid-City's really trying to make a run and build up its local chef-driven style restaurants. But yeah, so that was sort of the idea.
Now, is that in the same general direction as Alan's Pizza Domenica?
Complete opposite direction.
Completely opposite direction.
No, he's uptown, and that he's on Magazine, you gotta have a lot of resources to go open up on Magazine, whereas it was just myself and my two partners where that's another reason, we just didn't have a whole lot to rub together, so that's why we went to Mid-City as well, because Mid-City was an underserved area with crazy low rent, and we were able to find a spot that had been sitting empty for 4 years, and the landlord just really wanted someone in there and was willing to help us out and work with us and help us build something fun in hopes to bring some light to that little corner.
That's good. Now this is your flagship, MOFO, right?
It certainly is.
And Peter had asked me, I wanted to ask you because you have a couple other concepts rolling in there too. But Peter asked me, why would you do any Asian food? And I said that you grew up watching Yan Can.
I certainly did, and I think a lot of times I forget. So I was doing just straight fine dining for so long that I forget a lot of those influences. But it really is the food that we crave. You know, cooks and servers, it's what we go and eat on our day off. We all sort of carpool together and go caravan and eat Thai and Vietnamese, and it's what I've always been drawn to. Even when I lived in Germany, I would go skiing. It was great because there was a hill right behind where I worked, and I'd go ski all day. And after a long day of skiing, they had this really great little authentic Thai place, and just I loved curries. After being like in the freezing cold all day, a curry is just, it almost reminded me of New Orleans food, where it's really warming and very homey, and there's, you know, they put a lot of love into it. It's food that's been hammered on for so long, and so I just kind of identified with it. And so when we thought of the concept for MOFO, that was the idea. If we're going to do an industry-centric restaurant, let's do the food that we crave on our days off, the food that we want to eat.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's what chefs do. Did you ever learn to break down a chicken as fast as Martin Yan?
No, I don't think anyone's hands can. He existed in some other realm of physics where his hands could move that fast. I don't know how he did that.
I don't know how he does it. I really don't. Anyhow, so tell us about the newer ventures you're into now.
Well, what we do, it's really just smaller things. So we have some really good friends of ours, Stephen and Pauline Patterson, and they're Mid-City fixtures way above and beyond. They're kind of the king and queen of Mid-City, and they have Finn McCool's Irish Pub, which made it through Katrina and was almost became a community center because they reopened it right after the storm, and it was a place for people to go and right after the storm when the city was still just decimated. And you know, they lived hard hand to mouth for a long time to get it back up and running again because they lost everything in the storm. And now it is really just so many people go to that place in a day. And so we took over the kitchen there, and we do really simple pub grub. But they have a higher-end cocktail lounge about four blocks away that they just opened at the same time as MOFO opened. And they have a really nice kitchen in there that they put in, but they couldn't find anyone really to run it consistently. And so we took it over 2 months ago. And now we do sort of the same approach that we take to Southeast Asian at MOFO. We do sort of the same thing with Coastal Italian / Sicilian at Tana, which is a little pop-up inside of Trejo. But it's all house extruded pastas and really light flavors.
Gaetana was your grandmother's name. Gaetana?
Yes, it was actually my great grandmother was Gaetana Giacona, which is about as Sicilian as you can get.
Yeah,
and she was actually born in New Orleans, but then brought back to Sicily and raised in Sicily. And her younger sister was born in Sicily, and then she moved back to New Orleans when she was in her teens and met my great grandfather, and the rest is history there.
Oh, that's wonderful! Yeah, do you know how to make any of these, like? There are a number of Sicilian chefs around, you know, I don't know if you know them or not, but we're always threatening to get a kitchen space and get all together at Christmas or in the fall and make cucciadata. Do you know how to make cucciadata?
You know what? We didn't grow up making cucciadata. We made uncasciata.
What's that?
So every Christmas Eve we eat uncasciata and with anise sausage. And fried eggplant, and then we always have the traditional cassata for dessert. That's always our thing.
Really? You never did seven fishes?
Mm-mm. It was always uncasciata. That was what my great-grandmother always made, and that's what we just always did. It was always uncasciata. So, and for a little while, when my brother and I were, like, in our you know, middle school years, we were so tired of uncasciata, and now we can't get enough of it.
Yeah, well, now, You've been there for a long time, of course, in Orleans. You went back from Europe after Katrina, and you cooked through that. I mean, John Best was really involved with that recovery cooking, and so was John Fultz, actually.
Well, I got back. I was in Germany when Katrina hit, and then I got back in November, I was able to get back in and immediately took a sous chef position with Chef Besh, but we were all over the place. So, cooking, you know, making foie gras terrines and desserts at August at night, and then I was delivering food to St. Bernard Parish in the mornings to help relief workers, and, you know, that was kind of that was the move for a while until the city started to come back to life, and then I think that was about a year of doing that kind of crazy no sleep, serve fine dining at night, serve box lunches in the morning for relief workers, and then after about a year of that, I took over as the chef de cuisine of August, and then I did everything. I trained all the sous chefs. Typically, that was sort of the thing. Is I had worked for John for so long, and I had trained in a lot of the same places he had trained in Europe, that all the sous chefs came up under me, and then they were sort of dispersed to all the new restaurants.
Wow!
So it was an interesting time. Every time you got a sous chef trained, and you think you could take a day off, and they'd move them out to a new restaurant, and so you'd be like, okay, I guess I got to start over again.
Yeah, no,
that was kind of my game for a while, and then I was also Chef Besh's. Whenever he'd do dinners in different places, I'd usually have to go and help him put them out and set them up. So it was a great experience from being able to manage, because at any given point I could be dropped into a kitchen anywhere in the country and have to work with a crew I'd never met before and put out 6-course dinners.
Well, that's what an accomplished chef should do. Huh?
Yeah, well, it was kind of like boot camp training, so it makes everything now seem a little bit easier, I suppose. Yeah.
Now, let's just jump ahead a little bit. We've noticed a general expansion anytime we've gone back to New Orleans after Katrina. What changes would you note in today's New Orleans and what it was like before or even just after Katrina?
Well, it's an interesting scene here now. I mean, obviously we've got a lot of people who have moved in to the city, you know, and a lot of them were people that moved here before the storm, especially the chefs. I mean, most of the chefs, the big-time chefs who are making a big splashes in the community, aren't even from here. Most of them are guys who moved here before, and girls who moved here before Katrina, and stayed and have just watched the scene blossom. And so they're starting to really, you know, they came down here to learn our cuisine, and they really fell in love with it. But now they're reproducing their own interpretations, which is really great.
So it's much more diverse now.
Right, so you know, everyone's feeling more comfortable with bringing wherever they came from or whatever they're passionate about, and sort of interlacing that with the New Orleans culture, which has made it a really dynamic food scene, and one that's really, you know, the great thing about New Orleans cuisine, and if you're going to serve the New Orleans customer, your food just has to taste good. It has to be seasoned. It has to hit all those notes: hot, sour, salty, sweet, and textures, and those things have to be there because the New Orleans diner is used to very aggressively seasoned food. And so it's fun to see all these different chefs putting their takes on it, but always making sure that the food is just up to par, because it has to be.
Is there any one big fat trend you're looking at?
Oh, but no, there's just so many. You know, you've got Tobias Womack, who's down in the Bywater doing Red Chinese. You've got the guys doing 1,000 Figs that over on Esplanade. You've got, so many new food trucks. I mean, there's just so many great restaurants that are popping up, and every single one of them is bringing a better and better product.
Well,
but the thing is, it's friendly competition, so it means that we all have to get better.
Yeah, well, I really can't wait to get back there and see what's going on. I've never been at a loss for something wonderful to eat in NOLA. And now it was always a melting pot, but now just about everything, I guess. So.
Right, and I mean, just around the corner from me, you have Christina Quackenbush, who's doing the first real Filipino food in the city. I mean, there's just
that's an upcoming cuisine. That, you know, I don't think I've ever tasted the best of Philippine food because, I mean, there's always been something particular about it, like they're making it more healthy or they're doing this or doing that.
Right.
So I don't think I've tasted the best of Philippine food, but it is a rising trend, I'm sure.
No, she's doing the real deal. It's really great stuff.
Well, I'm asking Peter to catch us a plane.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a good idea, I think.
Well, I'm really glad to meet you too, and I'm sure we've met before.
And thank you so much for being a part of On the Menu today. It has been a pleasure, and it'll be even more of a pleasure when we meet in person and you can cook some of this wonderful food for us.
Please do. Let me know when you're on your way down to New Orleans. I'd love to.
Right, Michael. Good to talk to you.
Definitely.
We'll be back with more of On the Menu after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We now turn our attention to two women who are really central to all these new developments at the Carnegie Museum of Art. The first one is Laura Zorch, or is it Zork, McDermott, which is a lot easier, who has the marvelous title of Manager of Social Experiences. I think that's what I did most of my life, but I didn't have the title. Anyhow, and Sonia Finn, who's a chef, who's going to be a consultant on this dinner series, Feast, and also is expanding the whole meal food experience program at the Museum of Art and at the Andy Warhol Museum. Let's listen back-to-back to Laura and Sonia. I used to think I was pretty unique combining fine arts, a serious level of fine arts, with food, and it turns out there are a lot of us out there. We're going to be talking to one today, Laura McDermott, also known as Laura Zorch at one point, before she got married, and she combines her position at the Carnegie Museum of Art, where she is the manager of social experiences. I've always wanted to be the manager of social experiences. And also, she writes with three other women on a blog called Eat Pittsburgh and does restaurant reviews for the Tribune Review. Welcome, Laura.
Hi, Anne.
We're going to talk to you a little bit about it's sort of infant phase at this point, but you've started a dinner series called Feast, which combines a current art exhibition at the museum with a chef cooking an appropriately themed dinner. And your first one, I found it sort of hard to imagine, but once I heard what it was, it made perfect sense. It was the Mekong Delta meets the Mississippi Delta, right?
That is correct. Yes, we had a Vietnamese Creole fusion meal in celebration of our exhibition, The Living Need Light, The Dead Need Music, which I think when we first sort of thought of it, we were like, okay, we're going to have this meal that's going to fuse Vietnam with New Orleans. And I think everybody was kind of like, that seems not possible, but actually it is quite possible, and we found the perfect chef to do it. It was Michael Gulotta from New Orleans.
Yeah, Michael Gulotta is up for all kinds of awards. You know, he's really a rising star, and we're going to be talking to him about it, too. Tell me about the reception. How did people react to this?
So I think, you know, museums are known for doing sort of these big fundraising dinners. There's always something, big fancy black tie affairs at museums. And when I started at the museum in July, I really wanted to bring this, my love for food and my love for art together and really approach, you know, museum dinners in a different way and look to our exhibitions and our collections for inspiration that would then drive the meals that we bring to the table and really influence these sort of great parties that we could do. And maybe on a more casual level of, you know, not wearing black tie, but coming and sitting together and eating and really celebrating the artwork. So when we proposed the idea back in the summer, it was met, you know, really well by the museum administration. Everybody was like, you know, that sounds like a really good time. And then when we started spreading the word in early 2016 to the public and to our patrons, it was greeted with a great reception, and we sold out really quickly for the dinner. So we knew that people were interested in it and it was going to be great. And we, you know, just had the first dinner on February 12th, and it really was a wonderful time. You know, there's certainly movement in Pittsburgh, and I think around the country, that people are really interested in food, and they're interested in where it comes from, and they're interested in the chefs behind the food and understanding care and the time that it takes to create meals. And very similar to how people approach and react to art, is people want to know the artist, they want to know the background. That's how you actually are able to appreciate artwork. And I think that's the same way you're able to appreciate food as well. So there's this very natural alignment between artwork and eating.
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole bunch of us that have either art or our history background combined with food. I mean, the more I talk to people, the more I understand there has to be some sort of sensitivity or sensibility that overlaps between the two fields.
Absolutely. I think that a level of appreciation for food and for art that certainly sort of goes like to both, there's sort of border crossing mentality. I know that, like, my own personal background, I'm super into food. I've always loved food. I've always had that interest in eating.
Yeah.
And I have also always had an interest in art, and for me, they just seem like they're such a natural pair, and might be a leap for some to think that, but I do think that there's such an artwork in creating food. And, you know, I've talked with Michael, who the chef for the first feast, about, you know, that sort of idea, and he was more like, well, food is more of a craft. I'm like, I get that too, because it does take, you know, art, you can do it once. Somebody's painting a painting, and it's like, okay, that one painting stands on its own forever. But food, where you create something over and over, and it has to be great every single time. And I'm like, I get that too.
Now, if it was such a success, I imagine that you're going to plan other ones. I heard mention of November, but that's a long time off. Is that the earliest time you're going to be doing something?
It is. So for us, for 2016, since my position is new at the museum, and my position is to plan these social experiences, so I'm sort of filling the gap between a casual museum experience, somebody just coming to the museum and visiting, to the educational experiences of going to an art history class or going to a drawing class. We're sort of filling the gap between those two museum experiences and creating opportunities for people to experience the museum in a different way, in a more casual, fun, relaxed scenario. And so for 2016, we have planned out our calendar and feast as a series. We're doing twice. So we did one in February, and we'll do one in November. And then potentially in the future, like in 2017, we'll be doing it more than twice. I'd like to eventually get it on a quarterly schedule. But for this year, the November feast will be paired with an exhibition about a Brazilian artist, Helio Oiticica.
Oh.
And so we'll be doing a Brazilian feast.
Oh, no, that's great.
Yeah, which will be great.
What's the artwork like? I'm not sure. I don't know that artist.
Sure. So Helio Oiticica, the artworks are really these sort of immersive, participatory experiences. There'll be, you know, sand in the museum that people can walk through that's like, you know, like you're in a beach. It's called Eden. So you're really immersed. Like, you're going into these environments that Oiticica had created and really experiencing these in giant room installations.
Wow. And
yeah.
Well, you have a whole raft of Brazilian chefs to choose from.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that is really such an exciting thought. We haven't begun the planning process yet for that dinner, but we are really excited about what that could potentially be.
Yeah, so you don't even have a short list of chefs yet?
We currently do not, no. And actually, for the first dinner, we worked with Sonia Finn from Dinette, who actually helped us find Michael to do the feast for February. And I think we'll probably enlist her help again. She was incredibly helpful in knowing exactly the right person for us to find.
Well, I mean, I think it's a whole new dimension for the museum. And, yeah, you'll have fun doing it, too, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, is there some way that somebody could get on your mailing list, or is it only members?
Yes. Yeah, so if you anybody can join our mailing list. It's cmoa.org is our website, and you're able to sign up for our mailing list, and you'd be able to hear about these opportunities. Members typically, they could sometimes if you are a member, you could hear about events first, but we keep these all these programs pretty open to the public. Anybody can hear about it or come, and they're always listed online if you follow us on Facebook or if you are part of our mailing list.
Okay, listeners, remember it's Carnegie Museum of Art, but the CMOA is the address, .org. I hope that you're feeling better. Laura's been under the weather a little bit here, but Laura, thank you for taking time to talk to us about this, and continued luck with your series. Remember, it's Feast Dinner Series. You're matching exhibitions at the museum, art exhibitions with food arts in a way, right?
That's right. Okay. Yes. It's a delicious time at the museum.
Delicious time. Thanks, Laura.
Well, thank you, Anne.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
One of my best friends, even though I don't get to see her very much, is Sonia Finn, who's the chef owner of Dinette Pittsburgh. And Dinette is a rather special place. How would you define it, Sonia, just quickly, before we move on to our big subject for today?
Sure. Dinette is a neighborhood restaurant in the East Liberty neighborhood of Pittsburgh. It's owned by me, so it's chef-owned, chef-driven, and we have a changing menu of small plates, thin-crust pizzas, rooftop garden. I don't know if that totally explains it, but we just try to be ingredient-driven, making...
And totally sustainable.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Sustainable, not just with the menu and sourcing. That's, of course, very important, but also sustainable as a restaurant, sustainable with pay for employees, providing health insurance, sustainable in, you know, kitchen equipment, and just sort of every decision we make daily, we try to make the responsible decision.
And you have a four-year-old.
Correct, yes.
And so, you just got a new job.
Correct, yeah.
Tell us about, I mean, I'm interested in the, I've known the Carnegie Museum of Art for so long, and I don't know what has moved them to suddenly start expanding, which should have been kind of central to them, because big-time museums have really respectable, if not excellent, restaurant facilities, food facilities nowadays. That's the current status of the state of the art, actually. So Carnegie Museum has finally decided to do this, and they hired you. Now, what is your new position?
Well, actually, I was, they put out for bid this contract for the catering and for the cafe at the four museums of, the four Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh. So I was actually, I'm subcontracted through Culinaire International, who received the contract with Carnegie Museum. So I presented with them. So my official title is consulting chef for the Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh.
That includes the Science Center, the Warhol Museum, the Museum of Natural History, and the Art Museum.
Correct.
Yes.
And I am focusing mostly on this, on the cafe at the Carnegie. So what's currently the Carnegie Cafe, which is the this main beautiful 140-seat cafe in front
it's
of
gorgeous.
Fountains. Yeah.
It's gorgeous, and the food was always horrible.
Yes, it is. It is.
Horrible, I mean, and overpriced, and nobody ever wanted to eat there.
Yeah. And such a, I mean, it's just an inspiring space. So I actually used to take my son there at least every week, because we would go to the Natural History Museum, or go, you know, walk around the Carnegie Museum. And because I'm a chef and every outing that I ever have has to include a meal, we would end up at the museum cafe, and I would get, I don't know, like a garden burger or something, you know, and he would munch on something, and I would just sit there with him and look out at this gorgeous fountain, and up at, they have two, just maybe 10 feet by 6 foot Warhols of Andrew Carnegie in there, and just be in this amazing space and thinking, how can I get my food here? So it was just amazing, actually, that Culinaire got in touch with me about this. I don't know when contracts are up for bid or, you know, anything like this is happening, but actually three different companies who were going in to bid on this got in touch with me. I ended up going with Culinaire, and I guess my thought that my food was meant to be at the Carnegie was also shared by other people, if that many people approached me.
I was so excited, because it is perfect for the Carnegie. And
yeah.
It just is.
I just, and like you said, I mean, this is a big deal, and I realized that I need to really make this happen, because the Carnegie is such an amazing museum, and the space itself is amazing, and it really deserves top-notch food to go with that, and something, you know, something I hope, like my cuisine, that's modern and thoughtful, that people can enjoy and feels like it goes with being at the Carnegie Museum.
Now, I mean, what do you, you're under construction there now. I mean, was there a lot of redesigning to do in the kitchen?
Definitely. The kitchen is actually very cut in half, because they were using it for sort of like a cafeteria style. That's what was most recently done. So we need to cut down some walls. Unfortunately, our hood space is limited, so we probably are dealing with a, I think, 14-foot hood, so all cooking has to be under that, even though there is a lot of prep space. But at Dinette, I mean, my whole restaurant is 1,500 square feet, so I'm used to dealing with small spaces.
Yeah, me too.
Yes.
Now, are you going to be changing up the menu, I imagine?
Yes, definitely. And basically putting together a menu of some small plates, some sandwiches that are a little higher end entree size, like maybe one using Jameson Farm lamb and a classic lobster roll I would love to throw on there, some entree size salads, and then a few larger plates. And then I'm hoping also to do have at least a small oyster program, because I can just imagine, like, eating some raw oysters and sipping some sparkling in the Carnegie Museum. I mean, it couldn't be any better.
Now, you helped out with the launch of this special dinner series feast that the Carnegie just initiated, right?
Correct. I was approached by the people who were putting it together, the Carnegie, Brad Stevenson and Laura Zork, and they were putting together this communal meal feast, and they're hoping to have this as a series where they are, you know, putting dinners that fit with different exhibits that are entering in this Carnegie. But I'm sure Laura has talked to you more about this.
Yeah, she has, yeah. But you're going to be, I don't know if you know this or not, but you're going to be on call for all the other ones too.
Yes. Well, I feel like they gave me a huge challenge on the first one. So they were presenting the propeller group.
I couldn't believe that. I mean, yeah. It was just somebody who got the fusion of Vietnamese and Creole. Now that's really, congratulations on coming up with that one. And a
thank you. I told them they gave you a challenge at the beginning, but yes. I also told them if we can just find somebody who will roast the pig, actually, I was like, I think that'll bring together your feast. So we found it all in Michael. Yeah, Michael Galata.
So now, I mentioned to you, my interest in this is really in how art and food intersect. And you have some thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I think something where I could talk about this is I've always considered, I think it's a little hard to discuss that because if we're talking right now and with me, then I've always considered what I do a craft.
So does Michael, by the way.
Yes, yeah. And you know, Michael said an amazing thing when he was being interviewed by the Carnegie. He said, because I've never been able to really explain that, how I feel about it. Not that, but many chefs feel that way. But he said the reason he felt like it was a craft was because it needed to be replicated. And it was something that could be replicated. And I thought that was an amazing idea on his part,
art can be replicated too. Have you ever seen how many Rodins were cast at the Thinker?
Okay, well, but maybe I haven't thought it all the way through.
How about Prince?
On a minute. I mean, Andy Warhol is a classic.
He was a classic.
Yeah. He was a classic at that. You know, most of them look the same.
Well, I guess you're right about that. I guess. With the maybe it can be replicated with the approval of the person who first created it. It's a blessing.
It's interesting. We had this conversation with a well-known chef the other day. Was it Lydia Bastianich we were talking about? And she reminded us what other chefs have said to us, that you eat with your eyes as well as with your mouth, I guess.
Yeah.
So in fact, something looking really good on the plate is actually very important.
Yes, of course. Yeah, no, for sure. I, of course, agree with that. I mean, when your food comes to you, it has to impress you first. I think it has to impress you. It also has to make you feel comfortable in a way. Like, with my food, I feel like it needs to look beautiful, but you also need to not be confused by what's on your plate. So it needs to make each ingredient shine and you can actually see it and feel comfortable with what you're about to dig into, I think. But yeah, of course, I think plating is always, and how ingredients are treated to look nice, and then plating is always a focus, in any restaurant or with any chef.
I mentioned when I talked to Laura, there are so many of us who have combined art, fine art, studio art, and art history with food. And somebody suggested, one of our crowd both of us, there are many, many of us who are both art historians and food people, somebody said, well, you know, in art history, you get accustomed to noticing details in a work of art. And there's this concern with details and authenticity of details in food as well.
There's also that, would you like fries with that sort of concept? I don't know if you're familiar with that joke. But
are you going to have lots of fun, Sonia, with the Warhol Cafe? Are you going to do that one?
I am. I'm working on it right now.
You're going to have fun. It fun, huh?
Yeah, and the Warhol, I mean, the Warhol is such a wonderful space. I was actually, I've always felt connected to the Warhol, and I was an intern there in high school in the film and video department, and then during college, I worked at Interview Magazine, and...
Did you really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So it's, you know, when we were actually doing our presentation for Culinaire to... when Culinaire was doing their presentation to the Carnegie and they were to get the contract, we were really just focusing on the Carnegie Museum of Art and the cafe that was there and what we were going to do with that. And then Rachel Barron from the Warhol spoke up and said, well, what are you going to do at the Warhol? Uh-huh. And I said, well, whatever you want me to do. I would be happy, of course, to be over there. And And so I've been working with them over there. We right now we've set up a round of grab and go sandwiches. We did have sandwiches and salads. We did try out a panini, and I guess there was just too much. It just didn't work because there's no hood system in that cafe. So we're coming up with some other options right now. But but it's a whole new experience to me because it's writing down recipes and trying to get everything perfect and then presenting it, because I'm not making the food, so then presenting that to the cooks at the Carnegie now and training them through it and testing it out and, you know, here's what it looks like with now and then my feedback. And so that's brand new to me.
Well, I think you're used to having your own show.
Yeah, I'm used to doing it, and I'm used to not writing anything down. We don't even have a dough recipe at Dinette. We don't have, we only have a recipe for the pot au creme, and even then I feel like I'm adjusting things every once in a while. So this, I think it's a good exercise for me, though. As painful as it is to start writing down things in recipes, it's a good exercise for me because eventually I think my cooks would really appreciate it, actually, if I started writing down some recipes here as opposed to just sort of, you know, walking them through it. So it's a good practice for me. But also important at the Warhols, we're going to get some good wine over there. So I need to get that going, some good wine and beer. So.
Well, that fits. I mean, I'm not so sure that Andy cared much about food, but soup.
I did a little research on him when I was trying to come up with things in addition to the Campbell's soup, trying to come up with things to put on the Warhol menu, and found out that before he died, he actually was working on a concept for the Andy Mat in New York City, which
what?
Was like
an automat.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, I'm sure he had his, like, hands at everything, you know, he did, but that was kind of interesting, and so I was looking into that a little bit. He would drink what he called a nursery cocktail, which was, milk on ice.
Oh, my. No, it would have been right up there if you put some turmeric in it.
Yes, that's right. I was just listening to your interview on that,
Well, listen, I look forward. When can we expect this?
So I think we're working on design now, kitchen design. I think we're looking at August.
August.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's good. Everybody, listen up. You can go and have some fine food, finally, with fine art at the Carnegie. Sonia, I'm so glad you're on board with that, and thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the wonderful introduction. I really appreciate
you.
It.
Come on. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
At the beginning of today's program, we said we were going to come around full circle by the time we were done, and here we are completing the circle. Not only with a top restaurateur from New Orleans, Joanne Clevenger of Upper Line, which has been open now, she reminded us, for 33 years, quite amazing. And for the second time, or is it the third time in a row, Joanne's been nominated for the James Beard Awards Best Restaurateur in the Country. We wish her well, of course, for this, because she's a real soldier in the army of restaurateurs and a great lady and a great friend. But it turns out, not only that, but she's an art lover too. And so over the years, she's done a series of events collaborating with the New Orleans Museum of Art and shows they were having at the time.
And her restaurant is like a gallery, an art gallery.
Okay, yeah, yes. And I think you can even go home with some of the artwork if you're...
You can.
And probably take some of your leftovers too at the same time. So a generous-hearted, a wonderful lady restaurateur from New Orleans, Joanne Clevenger.
how many years have we known you, Joanne Clevenger?
Well, Anne, I'm not sure, but I've been opened the upper line in 33 years ago, and I don't know quite sure when you and I first caught up together.
I don't know, but it's been a time there. And you are in New Orleans, of course. The Upper Line is your restaurant, which is, it has endured despite a very tumultuous scene. And not just, well, I'm not talking just about Katrina. I'm talking about restaurants coming and going. But you're always there.
Well, I've been pretty persistent, but I think part of it is that my own stubbornness to not give up when the going gets tough.
Well, and you don't. Now, I originally was planning on talking about themed dinners because it stuck in my head that you did some spectacular dinners themed. You're near the Art Museum in New Orleans.
No, she's not.
I thought you were near the Art Museum.
No, she's a long way from the Art Museum.
Oh, I thought it was close. I don't have any sense of geography, unfortunately.
You get off the St. Charles trolley at, is it Bonaparte?
At Napoleon. Well, Napoleon.
Near Napoleon. The Art Museum's at the other end of the line.
Well, but it's
the other side in the City Park.
Well, but it's in that general direction.
Well, sure it is. I understand that.
Well,
I'm just trying to compliment you on your sense of geography.
Oh, thank you.
The thing about New Orleans is that we're pretty tight-knit geographically. I mean, we have the river and the lake surrounding us. It's almost like a little island. So we're not too far from any one part of New Orleans. The French Quarter, the Art Museum, the downtown, Upper Line, and the Garden District, we're all sort of in this little island.
Well, but I was trying to recall why you then had themed dinners. Particularly, I remember the Monet dinner coordinated with a Monet exhibit at the Art Museum.
Well, Anne, in my 20s, I lived in the French Quarter, and I had many friends who were artists. They would give me little pictures on my birthday. And so I've always collected art when I could afford to. And when I heard that they were going to do a show about Monet at our museum, it had these beautiful big water lilies on loan from the Marmiton Museum in Paris, I said, we will do a show. We will invite artists to paint pictures as a tribute to Monet and have them for sale. And at the very same time, I became aware that there was a book based on Monet's own recipes. It was called Monet's Table.
Amazing.
And I said, we have to do this. And it was very joyful because people would go to the museum exhibit and see the beautiful pictures, and then they would come to dinner at Upper Line. And we had the restaurant full of over 100 paintings of flowers that artists had painted as a tribute to Monet. And I had painted the dining room a beautiful yellow, which was the same color as his dining room. And I had bought blue and white plates that were similar to the blue and white Japanese plates he put on his dining room table. And then there was the food based on his own recipes.
What were some of them, the dishes?
Well, one of the very interesting ones was a green cake. And it was so beautiful in the picture in the book. But the reality was that the recipe didn't work too well. It was based on pistachios. So we had to modify the recipe a little bit. But there was another lovely recipe that reminded me of New Orleans. It was small onions, not baby onions, but just small onions that had been hollowed out and stuffed back with the onions sautéed with sausage and onions and seasonings that were very Creole in nature.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds Creole. Yeah.
It's very delicious. And so we had choices, and there was at least two choices in every category. And it changed as a three-month period. So every day we did that menu in addition to our regular menu. And as the time wore on, sometimes we made additional changes that were inspired by the book.
Wow.
Now, have you been to Monet's garden in
yes,
Giverny?
I have.
We have a picture of Anne and Peter that was taken by somebody else on our behalf in 2001, and it was like two or three days before 9/11.
Oh.
2001, and by the time the tragedy happened, we were already home, but the people who took the picture got to stay in Paris another week because there were no planes.
no place to get home. Well, nasturtiums are one of my very favorite flowers, and the nasturtiums at Giverny were so beautiful and so inspiring that I get goosebumpy when I think about them.
Aww.
And the colors he used indoors, inside the house, were very beautiful in that they sort of brought the outside in.
Right.
There was one thing about the experience of being a Giverny that I thought was very sad. Most everything there is quite the opposite. I mean, it's the happiest looking place. It's the most delightful looking place. The only thing that saddened me thinking about it was that he never saw it looking like that. I mean, I didn't know that. Well, how could he have? I mean, it's grown.
Oh, because his eyesight had deteriorated.
Well, it's grown for another 100 years since he was there.
Right, but even then, I mean, I've seen a photograph of him by that pond where the bridge was.
That's where our photograph is.
It looked very similar to the way it looks now. So I think perhaps parts of it were similar to what they are today.
Uh-huh.
He was a good garden planner. I'd like him to work on my garden.
Me too.
Now you just got some rather exciting news too, in addition to your Monet dinner. What was that?
Well, it's been an interesting year. This is the third year that I've been nominated for the James Beard Award for Outstanding Restaurateur. And Peter and Anne, I can't tell you how exciting that is for me and all the people that work with me at Upper Line.
It's sort of
like we get credibility in our own brains because we care so much about the happiness and the well-being of the guests. And to get this kind of national recognition means a great deal to us. But I also got an award this year from Southern Foodways Alliance.
Oh.
Which was very exciting because I got to go to Oxford, Mississippi, and they gave me a portrait of myself. And they did a very interesting video. The award is called the Craig Claiborne Lifetime Achievement Award.
Oh, wow.
And they followed me around for 2 days and did a video. And then beautiful editing reduced it to 8.5 minutes. And if you'd like to look at it, you can go online, just put my name in and put award.
Oh, well, we'll do that.
And it was very gratifying. So I've had the Southern Foodways Alliance, and now this James Beard. It just gives us a sense of, yes, we've been doing the right thing.
Well, I mean, the competition in your area, because it's a regional award, is very, very stiff.
It's very stiff because we have such passionate people.
Yes.
We have people who really want their guests to be happy. And restaurants are one of the few ways left that people actually are with other real people and not in the virtual reality. And so I think that the role of the restaurant becomes more important in the lives of our society because it's really about strangers breaking bread together. And I think that strengthens those ties between real people in our community. And, of course, at Upper Line, the art, in addition to the food, is another real thing that people can share with each other. Sometimes it's very interesting. Sometimes people say, now if you could have any painting, which one would you choose? And so they all decide on which one they would like to take home.
Interesting. Uh-huh. Now,
but you know, my favorite guest we ever had was Julia Child.
What did
she say?
We
had a dinner for her. But she was always very funny. She was always the most gracious lady you can imagine. We did a dinner party for her as a fundraiser for the American Institute of Wine and Food. And then we did a cocktail party at another year. And I think I got to drive her around. And I was never so taken with someone's reality as I was with her. Because she was extraordinarily gracious to strangers. But she was also very funny.
Oh, she's hysterical, I know. Yeah. She can deliver the best put down I've ever heard, too.
Well, she's a very smart woman.
Yes, she is.
And she was, she one of the things I was very taken, she never talked about food unless you talked about food.
Uh-huh.
Because she was so knowledgeable about literature and world affairs. But the thing I admired most, really, was her ability to always have a point of view. Well, I guess her willingness. Because many people in public life do not make their point of view known. They hedge a little bit. But she was always willing to say, this is what I think. I admire that.
And I bet Joanne Clevenger is quite a lot the same.
I
kind of seem to recall the first time we came by your place, we pitchforked you into our schedule because it was so tight, and we arrived at Upper Line at 5:30 or something like that, and you would not have it that we wouldn't have something to eat. even though we had dinner just down the street at Jason McDonald's place. On the avenue.
Yes, that. Yes,
that was so surprising. And so we arrived there at Jason's place, and we were already full.
We did a tasting menu, no less.
Yeah, I don't know what ever happened to him.
He ended up back in Australia, didn't he?
I think he did go back to Australia. I don't know if he's going back and forth or not. I haven't heard anything about him for about 2 years.
You've heard of him more recently than we have.
Well, you know, what's happening in New Orleans is there's some very interesting people writing about restaurants and chefs and restaurateurs. And so it's easier to keep track of what's going on in the world of restaurants than it used to be. I mean, Poppy Tooker has a radio show.
Yeah,
here.
We've interviewed her.
Wonderful. And Todd Price and Brett Anderson write about restaurants and bars in the Times-Picayune. And there's a man named Ian McNulty who writes for The Advocate. That's done some long-form pieces, but you don't see that often, the longer-form pieces. But just giving interesting stories about restaurants.
Eater is doing it online, the long-form, and it's interesting.
Oh, yes, yes. Gwendolyn Knapp, she's done some interesting things on Eater New Orleans. You're right.
Yeah.
I think she's doing some wonderful things. She or someone else there did an article about this man who's doing small-batch cane syrup.
Oh.
And he's growing his own cane and making it in very small batches, and it has a translucency that in visually and in the mouthfeel that is very exciting. Because I grew up with cane syrup, but it was always steams. And this is like the next step forward. His name is Charles Poirier, and I'm just thrilled that Gwendolyn wrote about him, and so I know more about cane syrup
than you ever needed to know, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's good to know that people are going back and retrieving those procedures and way of doing things that sometimes the knowledge gets lost, and then they never know how to do it again.
Right. There's so much going on in these small artisanal producers. We just were experimenting with turmeric root fresh. And Peter he made up a cocktail using it.
Really, because I bought some recently about 6 months ago at a Chinese store, and I didn't know what to do with it.
if you want to use it as a cocktail before you throw it out, you just slice it wafer thin. Put it in a glass. Add really good gin, really good English dry gin, and then rocks to your choice, and then wait about 5 minutes for it to infuse. It's delicious.
Okay, so you marinate it in the gin after you slice the gin.
You marinate it in the gin.
You wash it first.
Of
course, it's a root, yes.
But speaking of
gin, I invented two new cocktails this year.
Good
using
girl.
Dorothy Parker gin. There's a beautiful gin being made in Brooklyn, of all places, called Dorothy Parker Gin. Uh-huh. And last year, it has a picture of her on inside the bottle.
I
invented one called Dorothy Parker on the Bayou, which had some red huts and habaneros. And this year, I decided to go more classically Dorothy Parker. And this one this year is called Dorothy Parker on the Riviera.
Oh, wow. Oh. Hey, so Joanne, who's cooking at the upper line now?
Well, we have a man named Trent Osborne. He's my sixth main chef, African-American, from New Orleans.
Oh, he's New Orleans.
Worked for 8 years for Emeril as a chef de cuisine and sous chef, and has a very broad background. And he's doing some wonderful things that we haven't had before, taking tuna and using many fresh vegetables and exotic seasonings. But the main thing that I'm so happy for is that he's fine-tuned and tweaked the recipes that have been part of our menu for many years from the six main chefs I've had. Each of them is reflected on our menu. And Trent Osborne has made those better than they were in the beginning. And I'm so grateful and happy for that.
Well, we're putting you on our agenda for the next time we're in New Orleans.
Yeah, we're coming.
We're usually there. Well, we have been for 2 years, so we're due.
To the food and wine experience.
Oh, the food and wine experience. You know, that has been one of the amazing things in the journey of food to bring people together in New Orleans. When they first started, it wasn't such a big thing, but now it's grown to be something that people look forward to all year long.
Well, that's probably...
But, you know, they also look forward to the Oak Street Po' Boy Festival.
we need to come down for some of those great fried green tomatoes.
Yeah, yes. You still have those on your menu, huh?
Of course I do. And you know, I'm very proud of that, because when I first put those two things together, the remoulade and the fried green tomato, no one copied it for 3 years. And then in 95, Mr. Ulisich did. And then that sort of gave everybody permission to do it. And I think now it must be on thousands of menus. So I'm very proud that I created that dish. And out of the blue, you know, it just occurred to me that let's do it.
We will look forward to seeing you and tasting some.
And is your website upperline.com?
It is, upperline.com. And I hope, when y'all coming this year for food and wine?
Peter says we hope. I mean, he's the scheduler.
Well, I am delighted to have a chance to speak with you and share
you
with
too.
You.
And we will email you, although you don't read email. I may have to call and tell you when you could listen to it online.
Well, now that I know where your website is, I listened to a couple of them today. So I know how to sort of do your archives.
Uh-huh.
And one of these days I'm going to do my Jane Austen dinner again, because that was one of the theme dinners I enjoyed the most. And Thomas Jefferson.
That one would be great. So, all right, Joanne, I hope to see you soon. And thanks for talking to us.
And I enjoyed it so much.
Oh, me too. Bye-bye, Joanne.
Thank you, Peter. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And there you have it. Until next week, same time, same place. We'll be here. We hope you'll be here, too. And until then...
Bye-bye.